to the Mandela and the ANC compromise. But I thought it important just to mention that. One was that the whole settlement agreement had refused to revisit the 1913 land question. All right? By which time the division of land, so, and the entrenchment and ensconcement in private property had largely been left untouched. And there's no way you can redress poverty in South Africa right now without dealing with what we then call the land question. It's an African situation. It's a fundamental question of colonial dispossession.
That's Ken Salo, and sorry to interrupt him. Again, UPTV credited for getting that audio to me. Thanks again for the guys over there. And they have the whole 2 hours, and at some point we'll have it on UPTV and might be on demand on your computer. WBCP's got copies of the audio and just gave it to them this morning. They'll be running some of it starting just about right now, actually. I don't know what they're going to pick out. And I promoted a bunch of things that I didn't get. Ran into a guy on the bus stop today who said that Obama's called for the flags to be flown at half-mast and that when Maggie Thatcher died, they didn't. And he was entreated to do it and refused to. But I'm thinking that because the Reagan-Thatcher betrayal of the Lancaster Accord agreements would have instituted land reform in Zimbabwe, similar problems as in South Africa where colonial dispossession is still reigning. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. That, again, was from the Celebrating the Life of Nelson Mandela at the University YMCA just this past Thursday. Thanks to anybody that helped get me the copies. And sorry, I was storyboarding all the stuff that I didn't get on, and now I'm overdue to turn it over to the Labor Hour. Stalwarts are in the house. Thanks
Come
for
on, man.
Thanks for listening. There he is.
Just not working anymore. They used to call us working class.
jobs are gone, I ain't coming back now overseas. Might as well close the store. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the World Labor Hour here at WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM, and streaming at weft.org. This is Bob sitting in, filling in for David Johnson this week. I'm also here with Bill Gorell, and hopefully we'll have a guest calling in at about 11:30. Want to let you know that the views and opinions expressed during this program and are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, associates, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bill to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
Before that, Bob, I want to ask you a question.
What's that?
You are a bluesmonger, are you not?
Well, some people say that.
Okay. I've not heard of this guy. Who's the Shane Dwight guy?
He grew up out in California, moved to Nashville about 5 years ago. He's kind of a country blues rocking guy, you know, guitar player. He was actually here during the Champaign Blues Brews and Barbecue Fest during the last week in June, and he played last night out at the Fluid Events Center.
Ah, okay.
But not sure how that show went, you know, with all the snow and everything. Hopefully they had a good crowd out there.
So. Yeah, well, it's a big place. You see the lumber yard, man.
Hunman Lumber, yeah, yeah, over there on North Country Fair Drive. So
that's right. On the west side of town. So do they have a liquor license? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So there you get a little two buzz. It's easy to get out of town.
Jump on 72 and go. Yeah,
there you go.
Or 57. I think that might be one of the reasons that they put the place out there that, you know, they can get some people coming in from out of town. It's easy to get to right off of 72, 57, and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, and that's the location just happened to be there, too. You know, I mean, it become available. So
yeah, they spent a lot of time, a lot of time and effort remodeling that place. I was hoping to get out there last night myself and check it out because, you know, they advertise it or they say it's kind of like the largest entertainment arena outside of Chicago and downstate Illinois, something like that, or second largest, I guess, outside the Assembly Hall, or maybe, I'm not sure, but they say it's quite an expansive place. They can fit up to like 4,000 people in some of the, they've got different rooms for different size shows and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, I can think of several over 4,000 seat places, but I, you know, I'd always thought about the old Menards or that Best Buy that was on the north. Yeah. Out there by North Prospect.
Yeah.
And a place that I think could make a really kind of a cool, funky bar would be the old, it never made it, Dog and Suds out there by the new Menards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, that's kind of a funky building, you know.
Yeah, it's really weird.
It's a slanted roof like that.
And yeah, it looks like something out of the Jetsons.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it does kind of real retro, future retro. That's how I love that. Anyway, folks, that's a little bit of a chit chat about some local things that you can check out. So watch out for all the blues events going on, Fluid Center, and all the other nightclubs in town, and right. Make sure that. If you can, that you get out to them. And, Bob, aren't you the member of some organization about blues in town here that people might be interested in?
Prairie Crossroads Blues Society, yeah.
Prairie Crossroads Blues Society.
You can check them out at prairiecrossroadsblues.org.
And there's something else I'd like to bring up, and that is also you can give money to WEFT anytime that you want to.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be during a pledge drive, and there's various ways of doing it. And just check out the website.
The easiest way, right? Just go on the website, goes through PayPal, which is secure, and, you know, use any credit card you want pretty much, I think, through PayPal like that. So,
alrighty.
And now might be a good time of the year. Getting before the end of the year, if you've got some extra money and need to take a tax deduction or whatnot, can certainly consider WEFT.
Well, that's true. Not that I think a large number of our listeners will need a lot of tax deductions, but
not me.
If you just happen to, that would be okay. Now, and speaking of money and WEFT, we got people that are paying us to read these things. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information, or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. That's 328-2295, and we'll organize a union at your workplace. How's that sound? Okay.
There you go.
The Illinois World, the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide, which is actually 1 million more people than Watch Duck Dynasty.
Really?
Yes. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois, and that's a body that might also be known as the Central Labor Council.
Oh, really? Which
is, yeah, the most every city area has their Central Labor Council, and I can't pronounce it, so I'm glad it's not in the underwriting announcement. Okay, programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners to WFT and the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education, be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour and the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois. Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but to also give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. Sorry, folks, to subject you to all of those announcements, but last week we got in such an interesting conversation with our guest, Dr. Robert Boone.
Yes.
That we didn't get to all of them, and we apologize.
Yeah, we got them all in right at the beginning this week.
That's right.
And we're hoping we have our guest, Benjamin Day, call in from the national organization Healthcare Now, which advocates single-payer health care, and hopefully he'll call in from Boston here about 11:30. In the meantime, I guess we got some labor stories. I guess I'll start off here with the kind of continuing saga of Boeing and the contracts out there in Washington, Seattle area. Machinist union leaders rejected a second contract offer from Boeing, because it differed little from an offer that union members had already rejected by a large margin, a key union official said. Leaders of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, District 751, rejected the offer on Thursday without a membership vote, a decision that has sparked controversy with Washington Governor Jay Inslee among those weighing in. He says, "We've heard from some rank-and-file members and from leadership of the International that the agreement that emerged deserves a vote," Governor Inslee said. "That should happen soon, as I have become increasingly concerned that we are in a perilous point in our effort to bring the 777X to Washington State."
Ooh, that sounds like a wicked airplane.
The 777X?
Yeah.
Extended flight or something like that.
It's supposed to 666X.
Supposed to be using like carbon fiber and stuff, be real lightweight and get super gas mileage and be able to fly really far on not too much jet fuel, I guess.
That's so. What we need to do, Maz. We need to make stuff out of carbon so it's not getting loose into the atmosphere.
Instead of sticking it up out of chimneys and stuff like that.
Right, burning it. Make things out of it.
Yeah. In a statement emailed to Boeing machinists on Friday and posted on a union website, District 751 President Ted Robleski said that the company's offer was not sufficiently improved from one union members had voted down by a 2-to-1 margin last month. The company demanded that the union's top officials voice support for the proposal as a condition of its being put to the members for a vote, Robleski said. "When I said we couldn't do that, Boeing withdrew the offer immediately," Robleski said. So there remains a point of contention there. Boeing seems to say that they didn't withdraw the proposal, but the union officials seem to say that Boeing did. So I'm not sure what's going on there. In other details there, it says that Boeing's latest offer included an increase in the cash bonus for all machinists to $15,000 from $10,000 just to sign the contract. They dropped plans to reduce the pace of wage increases for new workers and offered concessions on dental benefits, the company and union official says. But it didn't alter the earlier Boeing proposal's cuts to other health care benefits or its conversion of workers' defined benefit pensions to a 401k-style retirement savings account going forward.
Why?
After the union turned down the first contract offer last month, Boeing received proposals from 22 states interested in hosting production of the 777X, the company said on Thursday. So a little more. Boeing had long envisioned building its 777X in Washington State, which last month offered, and we reported this here, an $8.7 billion package of tax incentives and other sweeteners to keep the work there, the largest such incentive package in U.S. history. Among other states believed to be in the bidding is South Carolina, where Boeing has a non-union factory that builds some of its 787 Dreamliners. Boeing this week completed a land deal to expand that site, giving it access to 468 acres of land to add to its current 264-acre campus. It plans to put a new hangar to paint its jets, an on-site fire station, and an operations center for its modified 747 cargo freighters there in South Carolina. So,
boy, I tell you what, man, when the FL-CIO didn't do their Southern thing back in post-war, you know, just after World War II, man, they left that whole part of the country open like that.
Yeah. We're going to play something after our show ends here today from the Union Edge, and they're talking to some people out of Michigan. And the fact that in Michigan, after they passed that right-to-work law and stuff like that, they haven't added any jobs. Actually, their unemployment's gone up in Michigan. So sometimes this right-to-work doesn't work out as well as people say it's touted to be, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought they're creating the business paradise in Michigan over the last year or so.
Well, Governor Snyder, yeah, you know, and if the cities can't afford to pay their bills, I guess you just take them over and put an executive director in there and void all the contracts you've made with anybody for the last 20 years. So Michigan's kind of living in its own little world up there.
Yeah, its neighbor Wisconsin has been pretty
tough
here, but. I would do something, but I don't even have a spinning thing on here, Dave. My spinning thing has even stopped.
Uh-oh.
And it won't move.
Is that because you have no access to the internet, Bill? Or
no, it's just that everything. Yeah, I got that, but I can't. I went to look for a story about a 16-year-old kid who had a blood alcohol level of 0.24. And I can't remember what state this was in now. And he slammed into four people and killed them.
Wow.
Four people who were, I guess, I believe they
pedestrians or in a car?
I think they had a flat tire, and there were actually four people that were, like, around this car.
Yeah.
And anyway, this kid got off with 10 years probation.
Hmm.
And he's got to go for a year to some really fancy treatment place where they'll be doing things like yoga and so, and it's all this really upscale, you know, fancy stuff. And the reason he's get this light sentence is that his lawyer argued that he suffered from affluenza. That his upper middle class parents, you know, just kind of never paid attention to him and just let him do whatever he wanted, wouldn't discipline him, and went and complained when, like, teachers and stuff would discipline him.
Right.
And so he thought he could just do anything, and so they're going to rehabilitate him.
Well, wonderful.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're sending him to Eric Clapton's Crossroads Center. You know, I always figured if I was coming out of going into drug rehab, that would be the place to go.
Yeah, I imagine if Eric Clapton went there, it was a pretty nice place. He was definitely in the throes of superstardom by the time he got there.
Well, yeah, I think he kind of helped build it or whatnot, you know, but on some Caribbean island, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Is it the Bahamas?
Somewhere like that, yeah.
But anyway, you know, but this guy is going to be getting sort of like this sort of spa kind of style. It was on CNN.
Hmm.
And what's his name? Anderson Cooper 360.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was interviewing the guy, and he was saying all this stuff. Oh, they'll be doing yoga and and have a nutritionist and get all this counseling and all kinds of this other stuff, you know, and for a year, and then be on, you know, just probation for 10 years.
That's
for
tough,
killing four people when you're drunker than hell.
Yeah, that's a tough curse to have too much money as you're growing up, you know.
Yeah, because of affluenza.
Affluenza.
I mean, you know, and that's,
I wonder how many other lawyers will try and use that as a defense.
Yeah, well, you know, and how about the kid that can't afford a lawyer?
Yeah.
You know, just get some...
public defender?
Yeah, overworked public defender that say, hey, man, we better plead to this because if you're found guilty, you're screwed, you know. So we got to plea and yeah, okay, yeah, you're going to have to do a few years and, you know... It's not, you know, I'm definitely not a super law and order Teflon guy. I would like to see the poor person also get the treatment that, you know, that kind of rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Oh, somebody's calling the station lines.
Yeah. Why don't we put on a quick little thing of music here and maybe Bill can get the phone for us there and we'll see what we can do from that point on. So here's a little bit of Tough Times from Kilborn Alley.
Me and my babe were talking, and what she said is true. Said seems like times are getting tough, like back in 92. You don't have a job, our bills are past due. So tell me, baby, what are we gonna do? Many hours a week, they had a big layoff, and they got for me. I'm broke and disgusted, in misery.
can't find no part-time job. Nothing in the house to eat. Tough times. Tough times is here once more. The grocery store, get a little more food on time. The man said, wait a minute, how do we stand? Said, I'm sorry to tell you, you're too far behind. Tough times, tough times is here once more.
Back. You are listening to the World Labor Hour here at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming at weft.org. I got a little story here that came out of In These Times, one of our sources for labor news here that I typically frequent during the week to find some stories, and this is about Uncle Sam's hiring practices. A pair of reports released this week show that the federal government routinely ignores worker safety and labor law violations when awarding contracts to private companies, and that American taxpayers are cheated in the process. First report comes from the staff of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, HELP Help Committee, which conducted a year-long investigation of federal contracting records, unveiled Wednesday by Help Chairman Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat out of Iowa. The report provides a long list of specific companies that break safety and labor laws yet continue to receive big government contracts. In particular, it names 49 law-breaking contractors that got more than $81 billion from Uncle Sam in 2012 alone, including AT&T, Home Depot, and GM. The Help report was paired with one from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, a Democratic Party advocacy group, which examined whether government contractors are actually fulfilling their contracts. The CAP report found that a number of companies shortchanged taxpayers through poor performance and named specific companies that stand out in this respect, including Lockheed Martin and KBR. Some of these scofflaw companies, such as international oil giant BP, overlapped with the Help report list. And the CAP report was presented Wednesday by Chairman John Podesta in a joint appearance with Harkin at CAP's Washington, D.C. headquarters. So interesting reports there that show that some of our money is not very well spent there by our own federal government, which we've all known that for a while.
Well, Bob, you know, there's something wrong. And it's something that I don't do enough of either, and that's we just all don't participate enough, and keep we got to be the watchdog on the watchdogs, you know.
And it starts with one place to start would be elections, and start with even local elections. We have to elect people locally that stand up for our voices, and then on a regional basis and on a national basis.
Well, also locally is sort of the farm team for the. Yeah. You know, that's somebody's got to start somewhere. There's very few people who can start out just running for Congress
right.
the first time.
Right.
And
a lot of our elections are so influenced by money these days, it's really sad. You know,
Yeah, see, and that's one of the problems, too. And besides that, the usual, like I said, the watchdogs, a lot of the usual watchdogs, the media, well, the media is, you know, they're corporate, they're complicit, they're part of it.
They got to put the corporate commercials on their stations, whether it's radio, TV, or put the ads in their newspapers or magazines. So, yeah.
And also, too, the personnel in the media, on the national level anyway, they have their class interest.
They
are, most of them are very well paid at the very least, even they would be technically employees or workers.
Yeah, you take any of those people that are on like a CNBC, you know, a money-based financial network like that, they're certainly not going to advocate for the poor and the lower class very often on that program, on any of their programs, so.
Jim Cramer, dude, man.
Well, Rick Santelli, the guy on the Chicago Board of Trade there or whatever, that kind of coined the whole Tea Party thing, you know?
Oh, yeah, that was really awful, man. Basically, most people don't remember this. Hey.
Hey, there's our caller.
Okay, it sounds like an interview, folks.
Yeah.
Ooh, where chitlins come from?
Let's get this tuned in here.
Well, I'll tell you, folks, I'm looking at a picture here on Facebook, and you don't want to know where chitlins come from.
Hello, you're on the air here at WEFT in Champaign. Is this Benjamin Day?
Yes, that's me.
Yeah, all wonderful, right. Wonderful. Glad to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Benjamin, you're with a group, national organization called Healthcare Now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And you folks, I know you got a website and stuff. That's healthcare-now.org.
That's right.
And you're a national group, and you advocate basically for single payer health coverage.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested and involved in this, and you know, what you and your organization are doing.
Sure. So, I mean, I think I got involved with this. My background was in the labor movement, actually, as a labor educator and labor researcher. I didn't know that much about the healthcare system until, like so many people here, I ended up having sort of a horror story with the healthcare system and health insurance coverage. I actually had insurance at the time, but I ended up with an inpatient stay for two or three days, and my insurance company refused to cover it. They said it should have been treated on an outpatient basis. Of course, I had no control over that. I just did what my doctors told me to, but
yeah.
Ended up with a $5,000 bill that, at a time when I was only making, I think, $14,000-$15,000 a year. So wow. There's just no way I could have possibly paid this bill. And I had to, you know, appeal it all the way up to the state of New York at the time. And, you know, this is right when I was trying to recover, actually, from some serious issues. And, you know, since I've gotten involved in healthcare advocacy, this is actually a very lucky story, and you know, it could have ended much worse, and just millions and millions of people have worse stories. And, you know, I think it's also, we tend to think of people who have health insurance as covered and, you know, they're sort of in a good shape. But I quickly figured out that, you know, having health insurance doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get access to care or be protected from catastrophic medical costs.
Hey, excuse me. My name's Bill. I'm co-host here. I just wanted to ask you, you had to spend a lot of time on this, didn't you, defending yourself against this debt?
Yeah.
A whole bunch of time, and that company spent a whole bunch of time, and they had people working for them spend a whole bunch of time and money. And don't you think you all could have been doing something better?
And you wonder why your healthcare costs are so high. I mean, I now know that over 80% of denials, closer to 90% of all denials, are eventually paid by insurance companies.
Really?
But, if they just deny at the beginning, first of all, you know, they know that some percentage of people will just pay it because they may not know that they're able to keep appealing it and keep fighting it, or they might not have the energy to do it. And also, even if they don't have to pay for another 4 or 5 months, they keep making interest on that money by keeping it in the bank and investing it. So, you know, we're the only country in the developed world where our healthcare system has this profound incentive to avoid covering people, which should be the goal of a healthcare system, is to cover people, not to avoid covering people.
Right.
Yeah, well, I find it to be like just a really huge, and there's something like 1,500 health insurance companies that all these medical care providers have to spend a lot of time and money dealing with, just keeping things straightened out and getting bills sent out and whatnot?
Yeah, no, you really put your finger on it. And I mean, oddly enough, you know, people assume that if we were to switch to universal care and if we covered it through taxes, that, you know, our taxes would go through the roof and it would cost a lot more money to cover everyone. But the countries who have universal care that covers everyone with public insurance, they pay half to a third what we do. And they have better health outcomes in pretty much everything, and they have the same quality of care that we have. And the reason is exactly what you just said, that it's so wasteful. It costs so much money for hospitals and doctors and other providers to wrestle with, you know, 1,000 different insurance companies, all that have different rules.
Yeah.
They each have like 10 different plans, and those all have different rules.
Sure.
And then they have to fight to get coverage for so much of it, and it wastes, you know, a tremendous percentage of every nurse's and doctor's time. And then they have an army of billing people, in a billing department. So all that money doesn't help us get access to care. It doesn't give us better quality of care. Just having one simple system that covers everyone with comprehensive care cuts down on so much administrative waste that literally you can use all that money to cover everyone else for free.
Well, there's another thing too. If you would take this and have Medicare for all, which is kind of part of you know, funding with Social Security and things like that, and raise the caps on the Social Security income the payroll tax, and perhaps applied it to other income rather than just earned income, that we could easily have, single payer, whatever you want to call it, Medicare for everybody without the average, everyday 99% of the people of the United States having much of a tax burden.
Yeah, I mean, we could switch to universal health care without anyone really noticing. Except for having, you know, no co-payments and deductibles anymore, but you wouldn't notice on your paycheck. So, you know, basically what would most plans would do is they'd replace the premium that your employer pays with a payroll tax that your employer pays, and you know, the employee would probably pay a small percentage of that as well. So it's not that different. The only big difference is that the way that we pay for it now, where you pay through a premium, you know, for a very wealthy person, a health care premium costs nothing to them. It's, you know, not even a percentage of their income. For a very low-income person, a premium is a lot of money. It's a huge percentage of their income.
Yes.
So it's really, our health care system is paid for on the backs of working people and low-income people. When you switch to a tax-based system, even if it's a payroll tax, it's more fair. The wealthy have to pay into the system a little bit, and it's less of an impossible burden, unaffordable burden on low-income people and on small businesses and employers, too. So,
We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, and they mentioned that, in effect, the government is already covering some of the costliest people out there, because we do have the VA system that takes care of veterans. We do have Medicare that takes care of a bunch of the elderly and stuff like that, Medicaid for the severely poor, and those are typically the people that end up costing the most money to take care of. And the insurance companies end up kind of cherry-picking the people that aren't going to cost that much money, and they make all their money off of the backs of these people.
Yeah. I mean, is there any other industry where the taxpayer covers takes all the people who cost the most and pay the least, and then we give to private industry the people who cost the least and pay the most? I mean, it's really a giveaway. I can't think of any other industry like it.
I was just thinking, for example, I remember one time when I was a kid, when my dad was sort of like, before he became elderly, I only remember one time when he ever had to be in the hospital. And that was, you know, and boy, I tell you though, once he got older, I was just really amazed at how much care that he could get, you know, it was incredible, you know, his last, say, 20 years of life or more.
I think there's statistics out there that say, like, you know, 80 or 90% of most people's health costs are all spent in the last 2 years of their life, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And even beyond that, they call it the 80-20 rule, that 80% of our healthcare costs come from 20% of the population. And, you know, if you're an insurance company, all you have to do to make money is avoid those 20% of expensive people. And you're going to make a healthy profit, and that means avoiding seniors, but it also means avoiding everyone with chronic illnesses, with disabilities. Women cost more than men do. So they do everything in their power to avoid the sick or potentially sick and to target the healthy.
Isn't it true that vast majority of bankruptcies in this country are due to health care costs, and that more than 50% of those actually have health insurance?
Yeah, and it's been going up over the years, too. The first time they did this study, I think it was 2003, about half of all bankruptcies were related to health care costs or to medical reasons. And then they did it again, I think in 2010, 2011, it was up to two-thirds of bankruptcies.
Wow.
Were due to medical costs. And the other thing that a lot of people don't know about is that home foreclosures, over 50% of home foreclosures, when you ask the person who's being foreclosed on, they say that medical costs are the reason that they couldn't keep paying their mortgage. And then if you include other things, you know, if you look at, you know, how much medical debt people have that they're paying off, it's up to, you know, two-thirds of people who are foreclosed on. A significant role is their medical costs and health issues. So, I mean, this healthcare crisis, it's not just a healthcare crisis. It underlies a lot of our other social and economic insecurities, both the housing crisis, but also, you know, our ability to fund anything through municipalities and states, you know, state services. Healthcare costs are taking up so much of those public budgets that, you know, we're cutting education spending, as a portion of those budgets. We're cutting public health, public safety, and those are all the things that prevent you from getting sick in the first place. So ironically, we're cutting off all of our funding for the social determinants of health,
right,
in order to pay for health care later.
Yeah.
So it's really, I think it's the crisis of our times that we really have to address.
Well, that reminds me about how those issues also affect how people are educated and their likelihood whether to be criminals or not in the future. And we sort of do the same thing there. We short everybody on the front end and pick them up on the back end where it's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, particularly mental health, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely true. And you can look at wages, too. I mean, you know, a lot of people... especially, you know, coming out of the labor movement, I think we look at the basically falling real wages for lower income workers. In the last 20 or 30 years, it's not just that their wages haven't gone up, they've gone down. Whereas, you know, CEO pay has just skyrocketed.
Yes.
I mean, I think our first inclination is to think that it's greed, that it's, you know, employers paying less and less for workers and paying more and more for themselves, and that is happening. But the other thing that's happening is that healthcare costs are rising so rapidly that they're eating into the wages. If you look at compensation, it's a different story. And there's an incredible graph that we use all the time where you can see every time healthcare costs rise rapidly, wages drop. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as healthcare costs start slowing, wages start going up. So it's also a major factor determining sort of the gutting of middle class pay in the U.S.
Almost every time there's a contract up for a renewal these days with any union, medical costs, you know, co-pays and things like that is always probably maybe the number one issue, even more so than wages these days.
Yeah. I mean, there's no pressure on wages to go up 12, 13, 15% mm-hmm. or 20% a year, but healthcare costs are rising that quickly.
Right.
Every strike that I've seen, you know, I live in Boston, Massachusetts. Every strike we've had around here in the last 5 years have been primarily around healthcare costs and healthcare coverage.
Yeah. So what can the average person out there who maybe advocates single payer, what can they do to become more involved, or what kind of action can they take to maybe?
Well, if you go to the website that y'all mentioned at the beginning of the show, healthcarenow.org, that healthcare is one word, and then -now.org, you can sign up on the website, and we will get you plugged in right away with actions that are going on. I mean, eventually this is going to have to lead to legislation. It's going to take probably a social movement to get there, though. So we have a lot of things going on. You can, and, you know, obviously an easy step is to try and move your legislator. But if your legislator is already on board, single-payer legislation, or if they're so conservative that it seems an impossible task, there's other things you can do. You can try and get your union local to endorse single-payer health care. Over 600 unions across the country have already endorsed. You can get your municipality, your town meeting, city council to endorse. There's a lot of things you can do. Most of them involve working in the communities that you're already a part of and trying to educate those folks. And we're happy to help out if anyone needs, us to send in a speaker or to provide you with materials to do the speaking yourself. So that would be my recommendation.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You say you started off in the labor movement. You want to give us a little bit of history about that?
Yeah, I was at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations in New York, which is it's sort of one of the few labor schools left in the country that does research on effective organizing and things like that. And it also a number of unions use it for their labor education for shop stewards and the like. So I was there for about 3 years, and then when I moved back to Boston, I was sort of looking for jobs. I was looking at the labor movement, but I was also looking at sort of broader organizing positions, and I just found this MassCare, which was the Massachusetts Single Payer Healthcare Advocacy Group, and it was right after I had this disastrous medical encounter that I was telling you about at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just very motivated to get involved with this and to fix this and to sort of bring the organizing principles and background that I had from the labor movement to this cause of trying to make healthcare right for everyone.
Excellent.
Oh, and by the way, you said you're involved in labor education in New York. Was that New York City?
I was in upstate New York. Actually,
oh, okay.
But that school does have, they do have a branch in New York City.
I thought maybe you might have run into Harry Kelber, but he was.
I don't know him personally, but.
Yeah, he's in the city. He went by, his website was, I imagine it still exists, it was a labor educator.
Uh-huh. Oh, great, yep.
So,
Harry Kelber was a great labor educator, rabble rouser. He passed away about a year ago, 90-some years old, and he was, just before that, he was wanting to run for the AFL-CIO. He was still actively involved in changing things.
Wow. So. I only hope I'm that active when I'm 90.
We all do, yeah.
God, I'm hoping I don't make it that far, actually.
Right.
Ways, but, yeah, I think he was like about 75 when I met him. But, that was interesting. But, you know, that's getting off track. Excuse me for that. I was just wondering if he had ever, you know, I don't remember talking to Harry much about healthcare in the past, but it's pretty.
Yeah, my sense is that in the labor movement, healthcare, you know, 5-10 years ago, healthcare was not it wasn't the central issue that it is today. During passage of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, the labor movement really funded this vast campaign to try and win a public option, which is, you know, it's far short of single payer. The idea was that you could sort of buy into a public plan like Medicare instead of a private health insurance plan. And, you know, they're a little less wasteful. It wouldn't be a single payer plan. It wouldn't make healthcare right. It wouldn't switch it from being a commodity you have to buy to a public service that everyone gets. But, you know, it might have been a small step, and, you know, we could have possibly put the private insurance companies out of business and enrolled more and more people in public health insurance. But even, you know, Congress being what it is the last few years, even that effort failed. And I think there's been a little bit demoralization with that, and a lot of people felt like we should have fought for single payer in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's the labor movement is coming around and is really changing. The last AFL-CIO convention had some strongly worded resolutions saying, especially since, you know, the Taft-Hartley funds, there's these multi-employer insurance plans that a lot of unions have their workers enrolled in.
Yes, I'm participating in them as a laborer. In fact, what I should, when I get home, is do my open enrollment.
Yeah. And before the end of the year strike. But a lot of those plans are now worried that they're going to go under as the Affordable Care Act is implemented, just because the union insurance plans are being treated very differently from private for-profit insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act. Hmm. You know, for-profit insurance plans can be offered through the exchanges, and that way, you know, workers can get subsidized care. If they're low income enough, you can get subsidies through it. Mm-hmm. But multi-employer, the union insurance plans cannot be offered through the exchange. So that means workers can't get subsidies, even if they would get subsidies by going through the exchanges. And also, there's a lot of credits for small business, small employers, if they mm-hmm. go through exchanges, and you can't get those if a small business is paying for health insurance through the union plans. So I know a lot of unions are really frightened that employers are going to stop paying into these union insurance funds and instead try and send their workers through the exchanges. So especially the building trades are really coming about and realizing this is starting to reach crisis levels and that we need a sort of a public health insurance system in the country.
Well, actually, a lot of the contractors I work for are quite often small family businesses, and sometimes I'll be working right with the person who owns the company. Wasn't there something like these good union health insurance plans, or weren't they calling them Cadillac plans? Well, we have to be paying some income tax on them, too.
Yeah, so this doesn't happen until 2018, but it's already having an impact. And when it does happen in 2018, it's going to be a catastrophe. So this is a tax on all insurance plans with high premiums. I can't remember off the top of my head what the numbers were. I think it was something like any individual plan that's over $14,000 or $15,000 a year and any family plan over $20-something thousand dollars a year. And once you hit that limit, when your premium gets high enough, you pay a 40% tax on every dollar over that premium amount. So you can imagine the impact this is going to have for plans that do hit that limit.
Really?
Employers are all going to shift. They're going to say, we can't be taxed 40%. We're going to have to increase your deductibles. We're going to have to increase your co-payments, anything to keep our premiums below this. And at the time it was being passed, even Obama was saying this is a tax on, like, Cadillac plans that are, you know,
right,
gold-plated and cover everyone. I mean, I feel like, you know, what we call Cadillac plans today were Yugos, you know, 30 years ago. And in any other country in the world, they would be considered shameful. The truth is that the plans with the highest premiums actually are not good coverage plans. They're the plans that cover older people because you can insurance companies can charge higher premiums for older people. And they're also the plans that are offered in states with high costs. I live in Massachusetts, which has the highest premiums of any state in the country, and that's it's because our in part it's because the cost of living is so high here. So, you know, every hospital worker has to be paid more. Every nurse, everyone in the medical system gets paid more, so it drives up the healthcare costs in general. But they estimated that in 2018, half of our plans will be hit by the Cadillac tax. So that's not, you know, that's not a tax on the extravagant plans. That's a tax on almost everybody.
Right.
So it's really it's discriminatory, and it's already causing employers to try and shift more and more towards high deductibles, high copayments, just to keep those premiums down. So that's a part of the law that doesn't get talked about a lot because it's a few years down the road. But it's really starting to transform and undermine quality coverage, and is going to do more and more so over the next couple of years.
I wanted to mention something again about the unions, and even though it's going to affect me personally, you might say, well, they kind of deserve it, because historically going back, you know, to Bill Clinton's time too, and before that, unions have been against government health care plans, at least for working age people, because it's, you can go, they do it. I mean, it was one of the big things with Starbucks and people like that who you don't think of as joining unions is going in and saying, we're going to get you health insurance. And it's actually is just, I'd say within the last 10 years where unions of the labor movement in general has pretty much been supportive of health care reform.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as you say, that used to be the case, and it is true that sort of part of the union advantage is, among other things, is usually health coverage, which non-union workers often can't get, even in the same sector, in the same industry. But, you know, the problem now is that sometimes unions own these health insurance plans, and now they're the ones who have to pass along high copayments and high deductibles to their workers. So, you know, even the union health plans are in crisis. They're just, the costs are out of control. So I don't think there's the same appeal anymore. And just to imagine a world like bargaining wages without having to deal with rising healthcare costs every year. I mean, if we look at Medicare as an example, I mean, can you remember the last time your Medicare payroll tax went up? I mean, you don't even have to think about it in contract negotiations because it's basically fixed. They've modestly increased the Medicare payroll tax, I think, two or three times in the last 30 years.
Wow.
By small amounts. But it's not even a reality in contract negotiations. Imagine if the entire healthcare bill was like that. Just the payroll tax that was fixed, it rarely went up. I mean, that's what it would be like if we had universal single-payer health care. And it would just let unions negotiate much better for their workers in terms of the things that matter, like wages, cost, quality of life, and other benefits. So,
once again, we're talking with Benjamin Day from the national organization Healthcare Now. And once again, you want to give us that website?
Sure. It's healthcare-now.org.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we're down to our last about minute, I believe.
Yeah, we're running
11:57.
Running out of town. Yeah. We want to thank you for calling in, Benjamin.
My pleasure.
Any last words for our listeners here at the World Labor Hour on WEFT in Champaign?
Sure, yeah. I want to, in the last second, just mention another really important organization called the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer Healthcare, which is a sister organization we work really closely with. But it's an advocacy group that specifically works to win support for single-payer healthcare as a right within the labor movement. So just Google them, Labor Campaign for Single-Payer. It's a really phenomenal organization, and I would encourage anyone who's involved in the labor movement to get involved with them.
Wonderful. Benjamin, thank you so much for calling in again. We really appreciate it, having you here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And we'll try and get you on again one of these days.
Anytime. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care, y'all.
Bye-bye.
All right, Bob. Well, I got a couple of lists here.
Yeah?
Real short ones. And there are people who, some of them might need mental health care.
Oh, yeah.
And that is, which professions have the most psychopaths?
Well, some people might say postal workers.
Actually, they don't make the top 10 list at all.
Okay.
The number 10 is civil servant.
Yeah.
Number 9, chef.
Yeah.
You know, that's.
Yeah. There's a lot of pressure in some of those.
Number 8, clergy person.
Well, yeah.
Number 7, police officer. Number 6, journalist. Number 5, surgeon. Number 4, salesperson. Number 3, and this is somehow separated from journalist, that is media, TV / radio.
Wow, okay.
Lawyer.
Yeah, well.
And guess. Yeah, Bob, can you guess number 1?
Well, after clergy person, I was going to say bartender. But
no, CEO.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
So there you go right there, folks. The top 10 psychopathic occupations.
Yeah. Well, after clergymen, I figured they were listening.